You're listening to All Things Considered on North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. I'm Jeff Tiberi. Lawmakers are on a summer break, scheduled to return in early August, but in the meantime, there is plenty to discuss. Here, as usual, for our Week in State Politics discussion is Rob Schofield from the Progressive North Carolina Justice Center and Becky Gray with the Conservative John Locke Foundation. Welcome.
Thank you, Jeff.
Before we look ahead, let's turn our attention back to the past few months. What's your biggest takeaway from the first half of 2017, Rob?
Well, from my perspective, it's another failed session. Again, it was tax cuts trumping basic public structures and services that hold together our middle-class society, our public schools, our children, our health, our well-being, health and well-being, natural environment, mental health. Everything suffered. We have a moderate, deeply purple state that's being controlled by a very conservative legislature that's in power because of gerrymandering, and they continue to pursue an agenda that is at odds with the views and best wishes and well-being of most of the people. So another disappointing session from my perspective.
Becky?
Well, after 5.5 months, what we saw was a continuation of an agenda of priorities of moving the state forward that was started in 2011 with the election of Republicans. This was an odd session to me, Jeff. It was kind of a hard session. They've taken up a lot of the low-hanging fruit, the transformational tax reform, the really rolling back of regulations, restructuring the way that we do infrastructure, bringing teacher pay up to a competitive level. I mean, there's still work to be done with that. So this was really a continuation. We saw additional tax relief for low-income, middle-class, really across the board. 99% of taxpayers got a tax cut under the personal income changes that were made. Continue to see some rollbacks of some of the carve-outs with corporate tax. Also moving forward with fewer regulations, really getting government out of the way. This continuation of an economic recovery that we've seen in North Carolina. That was kind of my takeaway. Not a lot of pizzazz, not a lot of fireworks, not a lot of, you know, the big things. It was just a continuation of this movement towards a more economically strong North Carolina.
My biggest takeaway, you didn't ask, but I'll share anyway. My biggest takeaway is probably just the heightened and continued heightened nature of partisan politics in the state, the fighting between the legislature and the executive branch. We should note, when Roy Cooper was elected last November, he was heading into a governorship that was already one of the weakest governorships in the country, as considered by experts. No line item veto, a low override threshold. But then, in December, of course, as many listeners will remember, lawmakers convened and they stripped him of some of his powers. At this point, Cooper may in fact be the least powerful governor in the country, which is interesting with just the dynamic of North Carolina politics. What more should he be doing? Can he be doing?
Well, about all he can do is take his message to the people. I mean, what we've really seen, I think, in North Carolina politics over the last several months is really the continued, I use the term, Trumpification of our state politics. The folks in charge, the conservatives and the General Assembly, have seen how Trump's sort of, you know, Katie bar the door, hard-nosed, in-your-face, Twitter-driven politics have worked for him, at least for now, so far, and they have been copying it pretty much and have taken the same sort of attitude towards their adversaries, most notably Governor Cooper, Attorney General Stein, most recently Secretary of State Marshall. Anybody that sort of gets in their way gets a full-blown assault, and that's been working for them. And there's not a whole lot Governor Cooper can do about it except take his message to the people and fight back.
What we've seen with Governor Cooper is his bully pulpit. He is the highest-ranking Democrat in North Carolina, and he is certainly doing his job of getting the Democrat agenda out there, of fighting back, pushing back from Republicans. Jeff, you mentioned the high partisan divide that we have, and we've certainly seen this. I think there's blame on both sides, to be honest with you. I think that the governor has certainly pushed back and pushed back and pushed back. We've had lawsuit after lawsuit after lawsuit, and the, as you mentioned, the governorship in North Carolina, just the way that we have our state government structured, the governor, not Governor Cooper, but the governorship is a very weak one compared to other states across the country. And then when you have a supermajority of Republicans in the General Assembly, they do have more power, and they are exercising it. And, you know, this isn't anything new. We saw saw this for the many, many years that Democrats were in charge. So it's just, it's kind of the same song, but different players are singing it this session.
As we chat, there are more than 100 bills on the governor's desk. He has 30 days to sign, veto, or let those become law without his signature. Among the policy before him, solar guidelines and a wind moratorium, regulations for driverless cars, changes to financial laws, and much, much more. What stands out to you, one or two?
Well, for me, I think the wind moratorium you mentioned, we've talked about that last week, is one that's a great concern, I think, to people who care about the survival of our planet and about moving forward to a clean energy future. That's something we hope he'll veto. There's a bill, this is a classic example of how the General Assembly went this session. There's a bill that was stuck into a dental insurance bill on the last days of session, House Bill 140, mended in secret. Nobody had ever seen it before. And what it does is it gives a giveaway to high-cost consumer finance companies. These are the folks that are already charging 40-50% interest, and now they can even pack their loans with more sort of junk insurance that they sell to people, so-called credit insurance. It's a huge ripoff. It's a classic example of how things went this session in terms of lack of process. There's another bill that attacks farm worker unions, sort of the same story. I'm very hopeful that Governor Cooper will veto some of these bills, although obviously he's going to have a very tough time sustaining them when the General Assembly returns.
Becky.
Well, you know, Jeff, as you mentioned, there's over 100 bills sitting on his desk, so there's a lot of stuff there. The energy bill is a big one. My analysis of that is that it gives many more subsidies and special treatment for the solar industry. We ought to back out of that and let energy truly become competitive.
You'd
I
like
hope
to see
he
the governor
vetoes
veto that.
I'd like to see the governor veto that. Yes, I would. There's also some stuff that has to do with municipal broadband that I think is significant as we continue to address the difference between rural areas and urban areas
in
North Carolina.
Bill?
Yeah.
310?
Mm-hmm. Yes. I think that made it through. You know, yes, it did.
Ma'am.
Yeah. So that's another one that we're watching. I think that's really a good idea to open that up to ensure, or at least put in place the infrastructure so that we can get broadband into the rural areas, make them more competitive, bring those economic advantages to all areas of the state. There's some things that have to do with public safety that I know he's going to be taking a close look at. And really all of these 110 bills, over 100 bills, are sitting on his desk. He's already vetoed a couple of them since they adjourned, and I do expect that we're going to see some more.
All right. This legislature will return in August to override probably many, if not all, of these gubernatorial vetoes. Then again in September, likely to deal with new state legislative maps when they may very well take up other issues, as we can recall from last December. Multiple sources have told me that a voter ID measure is in the works and that this time it would come in the form of a constitutional referendum. So the decision about whether or not to require photo identification of the polls would be left up, in fact, to the voters. What do you make of that?
Well, you know, North Carolina has a long tradition of not being a ballot initiative state like, say, California, where they have 20 or 30 ballot initiatives on every ballot each year. And I think that's generally actually been a good thing. But if we're going to go down that road, then I think we're going to have the worst of all situations now. We're going to have the legislature loading up the ballot with initiatives that they think that will favor their party in the general election. Whether voters will completely understand these initiatives or these proposals or not is a very open question. It clearly seems to be being done for partisan political purposes, and unfortunately it looks like that may be the way we're headed next year.
Jeff, what we've seen from polling and discussions over the last several years is that most North Carolinians agree that requiring a photo ID when you go to vote is a good idea. We've seen that voter ID question put into bills that have other changes to elections, and you know, we haven't had a clean voter ID bill, and that's one of the things that I've objected to.
When you say clean, we're talking about adding on early voting and just other major provisions.
Right, election provisions with it that then have gotten caught up in the courts and other things. You know, I've long believed that if it was a clean only voter ID bill, that would have been done a number of years ago. I think that putting it in front of the people, it's controversial, and there are arguments on both sides. I think it's a good idea to put it on a vote of the people, to put it into a referendum, and then make it part of our Constitution. One thing that we know is that when there is a voter ID requirement, people believe that there's integrity in the elections. And I think that's important. I think it's important as a public policy, as a good government kind of thing to do. So, and again, I think I have tremendous respect for the voters of North Carolina, and I like the idea of putting it in front of the voters, having that on the ballot.
course, there are dozens of other issues we could do that with. We could do that with a minimum wage. We could do that with gay rights. I mean, there are lots. We have done that with that. There are lots of other issues that we could, if we're going to go down this road, let's have a fair discussion about it.
And I would only add, and I'll put this out there if either of you want to respond. We're in a little bit of overtime here, so this is probably only going to the web. But in terms of integrity or in terms of fraud, there's no evidence of widespread fraud in this country, despite claims that were made following the gubernatorial race here last November. And there are certainly issues. There have been questions about the integrity of elections in this country, but there has not been evidence to support those claims. Is that fair?
I think that there is a lot of noise on both sides of that argument. I think that the argument that there's widespread voter fraud is exaggerated. I think that the claims that there are voters who have been disenfranchised is overstated. But a lot of this is perception. And if people feel like their vote is protected with having to provide a photo ID when they go to vote, and they believe in the integrity of it, and it encourages more people to vote because they believe that their vote is actually going to count, I think it's worth doing.
Yeah, and obviously I think from the perspective of poor people, people of color, people who have traditionally been disenfranchised in our country and for whom we have erected just innumerable roadblocks to voting, they don't have any doubt about what this is about. The message it sends is that your vote is not welcome, and that we're going to do what we can to stop you from voting. That's why voter ID was part of a broad-based monster voter suppression law, and I don't have any doubt that that's the message that will be sent once again. It may well pass. People may well not completely understand its full implications, but I don't think there's any doubt about what it's really designed to do. And if there was a determination by the people in power that it harmed Republicans some way to have voter ID, there's no chance it would ever be on the ballot or be enacted.
Well, I think it's important to note that most states do require a photo ID in order to vote. So, and when
it's about
25 to 30
now,
right,
I think.
Yes, I think.
I don't have it in front
I think
of
you're
me,
right.
But I believe it's in that neighborhood.
But
I think it's pretty evenly divided.
Okay.
But when you look at that, and you look at the voter participation, and if there are voters who are being disenfranchised by this requirement, it's just the research and the evidence is just not there.
Well, I show you lots of studies that say it is there. So that's something we'll have to keep discussing. I'm sure it sounds like, well, maybe we'll get lots of chances to discuss this in weeks and months.
I think that we'll have weeks and months of voter ID discussions available or at our disposal. Becky Gray is Senior Vice President at the John Locke Foundation. Rob Schofield is Director of Research at NC Policy Watch. Enjoy your weekend.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thanks, Jeff.